Simple question, I hope. What's the role of women in the emerging church?
Aha, that varies. and I actually think, well, I'll acknowledge now that most people in ICON say they're not part of the emerging church, but I think ICON, if you want to include them in that broader movement, are actually a good example of women's participation in the emerging church. When we looked at ICON compared to groups in the States, it seemed to us that women were much more kind of prominent in the planning of things and so forth. And I think in the States, there is kind of a recognition that men and women's roles should be equal. It doesn't always play out in practice. So in America, most of the key, like, stars or whatever, if you want to put it in those terms, Brian McLaren, Rob Bell, Tony Jones, they're, you know, middle-class white men, right? But you do get examples of people like Nadia Boltz, Weber, I'm speaking German, Weber, in a church in Colorado and so forth. So there are a few prominent women. So in theory, women are meant to be equal in doing everything that men can do. Your question actually brings out another aspect of emerging Christianity that is significant. And not all groups do this, but some groups strive for this leaderless structure, right? So when I mentioned that, you know, some groups don't even want clergy, you know, a lot of groups are kind of striving for that, you know, a totally egalitarian type of community or congregation. Now, of course, there's always problems with that because there's always hidden power structures and stuff within groups that are trying to be leaderless, but it is something that a lot of emerging groups are striving towards.
I appreciate that at times many of us need to be challenged in our faith and need to work at it to grow. But I'm just wondering what opportunities there are, what provision would there be for those who are maybe less intellectually questioning? You know, it sounds like it's quite hard, quite tiring, quite demanding to be working so hard at it all the time.
Well, so. Not much, to be perfectly honest. In some ways, there is kind of an elitist, highly educated vibe about emerging Christianity, and we talk a bit about that in the book. That's, you know, that's just part of what it is. I suppose what happens to a lot of people if they grow tired of the questioning, or often what happens for people that, particularly Gerardo, I think, would have come into contact too for the book, say the majority of people in the movement are, you know, under 35 and so on and so forth. There are some older ones, but say they get to the age where they have children, right? And, you know, they want them to go to church and Sunday school and this sort of thing. The emerging church really hasn't figured out yet, I don't think, how to do children, you know? So quite often those people at that point will start going to another more traditional congregation again. They might keep up varying degrees of involvement in their emerging community. But, I mean, you're right. It's a very demanding, intellectual, intense type of faith experience for the people who are in it. Yeah.
Gladys, from what you're saying, it sounds as though it's not just the institutions which emergent folk challenge and perhaps attempt to deconstruct, but it's also dogma, its cherished ideas, be they right or wrong. And certainly I think many of us would recognize a certain rigidity in evangelicalism and some security perhaps in holding on to ideas very firmly. But if we remove all of those, if we deconstruct everything, what is there to stop emergent thinking degenerating into nihilism? If folk are so comfortable with doubt, if, as I understand it, you know, atheists participate within emergent gatherings as pretty much as a member of that community or group, is there any kind of, is it just a matter of trust in God, if you like, that the movement doesn't just degenerate either into a kind of intellectual indulgence or into no fixed belief really in anything.
Again, another difficult question. I suppose just to pick up on one sort of phrase in your question, in which I probably actually said when I was speaking, this idea about being comfortable with doubt. I suppose emerging Christians actually don't want you to be comfortable. They want you to be uncomfortable all the time, you know. So that's part of the gig. But, you know, how to keep from degenerating into nothingness, you know. Like sociologically, this was actually a big problem for us, right? Because we're trying to make an argument in the book to a sociology of religion audience that this movement is significant. And it's hard to make an argument about a movement that is more than happy to see itself disappear or disintegrate, you know. So your question is kind of related to that process as well. But I think for us, the thing that would keep it from total disintegration is the commitment that the people have to the particular community or the relationships with the other individuals they're involved with. That is the thing to keep it together, the personal relationships rather than the institution itself. And whether that will actually work in the long term, you know, again, is up for debate because, you know, obviously I'm a sociologist, and one of the classic arguments of sociology is that institutions develop in order to, you know, keep things going, keep things running smoothly. They're convenient things for societies to have. So a movement that's deliberately anti-institutional kind of is a direct challenge to that, and the jury really is still out to whether it works in the long term.
Phyllis Tickle, in her book The Great Emergence, she talks about these hinge moments, looking back at the Reformation, before that the Great Schism, were these periods of time where circumstances change and society changes and people think about fresh things, and the Enlightenment makes you independent thinking on your own. What do you make of the idea that the emergent church is, you know, 500 years later, it's a new Reformation. It's not so much a thing that's happening outside of the church, like in your book, Evangelical Journeys, people are leaving. That not as something that's happening separate from the church, but something like the Reformation that happened to the church and is a good, right, and proper thing, and a natural thing.
So you're asking, Well, Phyllis Tickle's argument is that the emergence movement is one of these hinge moments, and in 500 years we're going to see that the changes being brought about by the emerging church were the significant aspects of the Reformation or a new Reformation of Christianity, particularly in the West. You know, that's her argument. I mean, as a sociologist, we don't make arguments like that. We don't sort of predict the future, you know. But you can certainly, I think Phyllis Tickle is very enthusiastic, and she can be quite persuasive. You can see why she thinks this. And one of the reasons she thinks this is because the ideas and the practices of emerging Christianity do fit very well with the way society, culture, institutions in the West are developing at the current time. And one of the best examples of that is the use of networks and social networks. Actually, in the book, we talk quite a lot about how emerging Christians organize themselves in networks. You know, they don't want denominations, but they don't want to be isolated either. So there would be networks of people, United States, UK, Australia, or whatever, who connect themselves virtually, right? And this is the same thing that people are doing in other aspects of society. And, you know, one of the, you know, the positive arguments about the internet as well is that it gives, you know, everybody a voice and a place for debate and so on and so forth. And again, this is what the emerging church tries to do through its use of online networks and social networks and so forth. So the way it kind of resonates with trends like that, I think, is a key part of her argument, and something that we also pick up on and see as significant. In the book, I think the phrase we use is that we see emerging Christianity as one of the most important reframings of Western Christianity in the last 20 years. So we do think it is significant and important. Maybe we're not as bold as Phyllis Tickle, because she's a, I suppose would, some might say she's a visionary and a spokesperson for this movement. We're not that, but we do see the sociological trends that kind of support its continuance. But at the same time, even though we see it continuing, we don't necessarily think that something called the emerging church could be around even in 15 or 20 years. We think that there's potential for it to kind of infiltrate and influence other types of Christianity, change their practices, change the way they think about certain ideas and doctrines. So it's a more kind of insidious thing, particularly with these people's reluctance to be defined or to want to build institutions. You know, there might not even be something called the emerging church, but, you know, it could be what we're calling emerging Christianity now that has somehow changed the whole Christian picture in the West. Does that make sense? Oh, we're not saying we're all emerging Christians. No, we're saying that the way that it resonates with the contemporary culture, it's fertile ground, I suppose. That would be more be the way to put it. Yeah.
Gladys, a lot of the examples are English, Western, the kind of Rollins-McLaren axis. Is there any evidence of it in other parts of the world? And as a kind of an add-on, you included the dock as one of the examples
in
the book. Do you want to talk a wee bit about why that kind of filters through the emergent gap?
Okay, I'll tackle the other parts of the world one first. There are a few like edited collections about the emerging church that try to give some examples from Africa and Latin America, but I don't really buy it. I think it is primarily a Western movement, and certainly even in the West, you know, if you try to count it, it's not very big. I think in the developing world, the key expression of Christianity is obviously Pentecostal and charismatic Christianity. That is sort of the clear winner and the thing that is most influential and most appealing and most significant. But the thing that's interesting about Pentecostal, charismatic, and the emerging church is that they're both very individualistic types, expressions of Christianity. They really encourage individual spiritual development and so forth. So there are, I think, compatibilities in an odd sort of way in the processes that have produced Pentecostal charismatic Christianity and the emerging church. And of course, I mean, charismatic Christianity in the West is also, I think, the fastest growing form of Christianity in the West too. So I suppose it makes sense that it is a product of modernity the same way the emerging church is a product of modernity. And what's interesting is that both these products of modernity are so individualistic and don't care that much about institutions. Charismatic churches, they're more institutional than the emerging church, but they, you know, they're very quite often organized on a single congregational model and so forth. Now the question about the dock. I suppose one of the reasons I included the dock is that to me it seemed like a kind of had a lot of parallels with the Fresh Expressions movement in the United Kingdom. And the Fresh Expressions movement in the UK, you know, with the Anglican Church and the Methodist Church. Are people familiar with what this is? Do you kind of? It's basically, I suppose, a kind of project of those two churches in the UK where they create alternative congregations. So sometimes these are pub churches, sometimes these are cafe churches, sometimes these are, you know, that messy church thing some of you may have heard of where people kind of pile in and bring the kids and so on and so forth. So what we think is that in the UK this Fresh Expressions is the key outworking of the emerging church, but it's different than the United States because it has that link with the traditional denomination, so it's not quite as anti-institutional. So the dock, obviously, with one of the key people in it being a Church of Ireland minister, I thought, so this has had to have been influenced by Fresh Expressions and so forth in the way that it is quite so innovative with the way it does church, you know, with the dock walks, which are very conversational, which is kind of classic kind of methodology in the emerging church. And so forth. And I did ask the people at the dock, you know, do you see yourself as part of Fresh Expressions? They're kind of like, no, you know, but I suppose we included them in the book because I thought, again, this religious orientation that they represented was a good example of it. And funny enough, even some of the Americans who have read this book asked me about the example of the dock because they think it's quite compelling. So I was at a conference in San Francisco last month, and a few people that, you know, picked out the dock as the example they thought was interesting. you know, just the kind of the practices that are quite, you know, different, and the very, I suppose, one of the things on the DOC website that illustrates this is how when it tells about the staff, you know, and it says what denomination they're from, but it's like, but we don't want to think in those terms anymore. Who wants to be put in a denominational box? So again, this fits what we see as the orientation of emerging Christianity. And while it may not be on the radical fringe where Pete Rollins kind of dances, you know, we thought it could be included. Oh no, question for my husband.
I'm about as far removed as you can get from a Christian scholar, but being married to you, I picked this stuff up by osmosis. So what I was thinking of is just when you were talking is, because one of a lot of criticisms you always get is that the movement's small and some of the thing about, you know, what's it, it's all about deconstructing, it's not about building, etc. But to me, what I see from an outsider is that it's about trying to shake up people's complicity, complacency, should I say, with the churches. So it's not that they want to necessarily trying to create something new. It's just they're trying to shake things, the current situation and the complacency of a lot of the churches. And to me, I mean, I see it as like, it's almost like in the music industry where, well, Steve will know more about this, where you get a lot of particular classic acts who, like Velvet Underground or whatever, he didn't sell many albums at the time, but they have these kind of ripple effects. And like in fashion, you'll get the same thing, you know, where, or like punk music. So essentially, it's about shaking things up rather than actually trying to create a whole new church, if you know what I mean.
Well, they certainly don't want to create a church. Oh. No, but no, that's a valid comment, I think, for some of the people. Yeah.
I'm definitely getting my work in tonight. I had the pleasure of hearing Shane Claiborne and Tony Campolo a couple of years back in Belfast, and I don't think they would have put emerging Christians as their title, but they certainly would have said we are red letter Christians. I don't know, Glass, whether you'd agree or not, but that is what I see as coming to the fore here. I mean, not just in this congregation, but across Belfast. We're up in Coleraine last week at the Vineyard Church, and we're seeing more and more people putting into practice what Jesus asked us to do. And whether that means networking in terms of things like Christians Against Poverty, food banks, our own church at Willowfield, we're involved in pub ministry, we're doing healing on the streets. It's all the sort of things that Jesus commanded us to do. I just wondered, do you see the emerging Christianity, the emerging church movement, as a reflection of that?
Well, I think that's they want to be a reflection of that, really. That's one of their core ideas, that the church should be more interested in social justice and looking after the poor and so on and so forth. Yeah, Campolo and Claiborne, you know, I don't think they identify directly with the emerging church movement like no, but hardly anybody does, really, in some ways. It's a you know, this lack of, you know, this not wanting to be identified is part of the orientation anyway. But setting that aside, the new monastic thing, including that as part of the emerging church, I think that's really important. And we're not alone in doing that. One of the earlier books in the U.S. written by a guy called James Biello about the emerging church had two chapters that focused on new monasticism. And this new monastic idea, it is, you know, it's all about this practical kind of Christianity lived out on the ground. And in some ways, I think even emerging Christians who aren't involved specifically with new monastic communities, that's almost like what a lot of them wish they were involved in or could be doing. You know, it's that type of thing. And another key aspect of that, I suppose, is, and you get this in varying degrees, is the critique that comes along with that of the capitalist structures, right? So what a lot of those new monastic communities are trying to do is live outside of the structure, is kind of this, Kester Bruin's term is a temporary autonomous zone where they're, you know, ideally untouched by capitalism and can, you know, live a better way. Of course, again, it's one of these things that's nearly impossible to do, but it's the ideal, I think, that they're striving towards.
This might be picking up a little bit on what you've just said there, but I'm quite interested to know perhaps where the emerging church sees its relationship with existing church and perhaps with society as a whole. You know, is there a vision or mission for change, or is it we're just going to get on with this anyway and hopefully we'll impact you? Or is there actually some form of agenda there at all?
I think there's a spectrum of how people in emerging Christianity would answer that question. I think in the UK, particularly with Fresh Expressions, the relationship with the existing churches is much more tangible, real. I don't know if healthy is the right word, because those who critique Fresh Expressions say that they're too closely tied to those institutions, you know, that those closer relationship means that they won't be able to give the same radical critique that maybe some of the American ones, which aren't so closely tied to particular denominations, are able to do. So you get a spectrum of that on how close the relationships are with existing churches and so on and so forth. And the other bit was about relationship to society, whether wanting to change society. I suppose the idea is, I think it goes back to the thing about trying to live outside of the structures of society and kind of critiquing society, culture, politics by that lifestyle. That's the modus operandi, you know. And it is very small scale, you know. It's very hard to affect a macro level of change in society when you're doing that. But that's the strategy. I don't know if agenda is the right word for it, but I suppose it's to exist as a critique of society. And again, some of the critiques of the emerging church are, like, if you really want to change these unjust structures of capitalism, you have to do more than that, right? You have to attack the structures directly. But as of yet, there's not really a concerted movement within emerging Christianity to do that.
Hi. I'm not really sure if I know totally how to word my question or whether you'll be able to answer it, but I just wanted to ask a wee bit about what you'd said about the person of Jesus and, you know, what the purpose of, you know, the crucifixion, the resurrection, what the meaning of that really was. And also just, you know, you're talking about emerging Christianity, but what the relationship is with other religions, you know, the person of Jesus and other people who have been, I don't really know how to put it, but yeah, just the relationship with other religions. When you deconstruct, you know, why just deconstruct back to the basis of Christianity, if that makes sense at all?
Yeah. Okay, so the person of Jesus, I think you could definitely say that the preferred description of Jesus within emerging Christianity is kind of Jesus the man, right? It's not kind of the cosmic, triumphant, Jesus is king type of figure. You get the kind of poor, humble, suffering servant type Jesus who walked among us. I mean, that's the preferred picture. In terms of the meaning of the crucifixion and the cross and so forth, again, within emerging Christianity, there is a spectrum of, I suppose, ideas or beliefs about, you know, what this means. And Pete Rollins, again, he'd probably be out on the edge of this. I can just find, in one of his later books, he kind of actually redefines crucifixion. And to summarize his definition, it's here in a paper Gerardo and I wrote just about Icon. You could really boil his definition of crucifixion down, I think, to experiencing and embracing doubt. So Christ on the cross, that experience he went through of doubt, you know, my God, why have you forsaken me? To identify with that is to experience the crucifixion. And then the resurrection then becomes that authentic mode of living, like God doesn't exist. This idea that you are living more authentically as a Christian if you can live well as if God did not exist and he wasn't there to reward or punish you, you know, you should be able to live well without that kind of figure up there whom you're either in terror of or trying to appease. But again, those would be, I think Pete is on the fringe of pushing that. And particularly in the States, you would get more conventional ideas about the crucifixion and the resurrection and what they mean. And I suppose, and different ideas about the uniqueness of Jesus. And in terms of other religions, there's certainly openness to, I suppose, dialogue and conversation with people of other religions, and certainly no attempt to convert people of other religions to Christianity. So a recognition that it's actually not the job of Christians to convert people of other religions. I think most emerging Christians would probably say that. And again, that is, you know, something that is a very direct, I suppose, contradiction of evangelicalism, I suppose, in most of its traditional forms. Does that answer everything?
Can I just follow that while it's there, and we'll keep the questions? I'm interested in the doubt one and the crucifixion one. I'm interested in that Jesus was seen as doubting in the cross because he screams, my God, why have you forsaken me? Because upstairs just a few weeks ago, that came up in one of our actually studies on the person of Mary. And Ken Newell, my predecessor, actually read out Psalm 22, which that's quoting. It's not really about doubt or actually a cutting off of God and Jesus. It's an intimate psalm of, well, it's intimacy. It's a kind of a, there's almost a trust-like thing going on there. So my question from that is, what is the biblical scholarship within emerging church? And what are they, because you've talked a lot about how well they've critiqued society and critiqued the institutional church. But when some of this stuff comes through, is there good biblical scholarship in there? I mean, I know some that are involved in ICON who are very good biblical scholars. But across the board, is there a good, robust biblical scholarship going on, or is that even frowned upon?
That's a hard question for a sociologist to answer. You know, so I suppose in some ways that's dodging the question a bit. I'm not really qualified to judge who's a good biblical scholar, but I mean, I suppose I can say that most of the prominent voices associated with the movement don't come from a background of biblical scholarship. It would be sort of philosophy, literature, English, those types of humanities types backgrounds more than biblical scholarship, I would think. But I suppose the way of reading the Bible, the emphasis on narrative and story, and an idea that quite a few emerging Christians would have, that yes, they would say the Bible contradicts itself, but you know, so what, right? It's not a problem if there's contradictions. It's not a problem if things don't match up in the way that, you know, some people might try to make them match up. Don't know how this is doing a very good job answering your question or not.
Jeepers, I got carried away there and I've forgotten what my question was. I don't know if you can actually answer this question or not, but maybe it's more of a comment, but it strikes me throughout my adult life that maybe most congregations actually have a section of emergent Christians, because what you've listed doesn't sound radically different. I've spent my adult life with people who've been fed up with where the church has been and the political ties that it has, are struggling with doubt and wanting a little more room sometimes from churches that are asking for a very rigid belief structure, and faced with, but what do you do if you can't drum up enough belief to be part of that? And just questioning various structures, gender imbalance, or the role of the church or the institutionalized church. So I suppose maybe it's a rhetorical point, but do most congregations, most churches, not have some aspect of emergency not emergency.
Emergency. Although, Freudian slip there.
They probably do in that sense too, but you know what I mean? It's a natural part of any congregation as it struggles. And if it doesn't struggle with that, the congregation probably doesn't survive in the long run.
Well, that's actually a key part of our argument for why emerging Christianity is significant. So thanks for clarifying that. No, we do think, you know, that there are people within most conversations that have this experience. Not all of them leave and join emerging communities and so forth, but you know, our argument that this is a significant reframing of Western Christianity is based on our kind of, I suppose, research and knowledge that there are people out there, not in emerging churches per se, who are going through these same processes, having these same ideas, asking these same questions, even sharing that religious orientation without saying, you know, I'm an emerging Christian.
Can I just hold the microphone 2 seconds? And can I just flag up, I think Brian McLaren's book, the central one of that is that the story we find ourselves in, just for anybody interested, that is a really interesting place to start. And I have to say, even just to give an example of what we talked about, the atonement, and I know in the room there are probably alarm bells ringing of, what, he doesn't believe that, but actually that's not the case. And in that book he flags up a number of ways to look at the crucifixion, which from memory I think I was happy to have all of which are compatible and biblical as far as I could see. But he tries to draw out that looking at one of those ways rigidly to the exclusion of others can take individual churches in different directions.
Yeah.
So I think it's the story we find ourselves in is a good place to start. I certainly haven't felt that what I read there was incompatible with my membership of Fitzroy, that there was any kind of tension between the two. I didn't think there was.
Just to pick up on Dave's point, yes, there are little emergent pockets within congregations. Maybe Fitzroy more than others, but would you not agree that there's a sense of urgency then for churches, because these people are leaving.
Yes.
They are going.
Yeah.
They aren't in church. And so it's different in that sense, that there is something to do. This is happening, and the church is going to get left behind.
Yeah, I mean, there's people within emerging Christianity, I mean, to put it in the language, you know, that sounds, I don't know, too managerial or something, but the existing churches aren't fit for purpose, so we should just let them die and let whatever emerges, you know, emerge, and we'll all be in a better place. I think that's what a lot would think. So it's a debate how much effort is put into saving existing institutions versus developing something new.
Yeah, like on some levels, the dock is an example of emergent church, but fundamentally they're still evangelicals, you know, with a version of the atonement that goes as standard. But emergent Christians who are leaving the church are saying things like, there are some, like in Pete Rollins' case, there are some Jesuses that need to be rejected, and they are rejecting theology of atonement that they believe is wrong. And so it's, yeah.
Yes, there are some people who would clearly say some theologies are wrong.
The church itself and people, what do they actually meet? Do they all meet together or congregate together in groups, in houses or churches, or in churches, but how do these all meet together?
Sorry, what was that? I didn't quite... Oh, how do emerging congregations meet? Oh, there's a variety of ways, I suppose. So some would do stuff like meet in pubs, right, and kind of chat around a table. Others would kind of take over disused urban spaces. So like Rob Bell, one of the American figures, his first church was in an old shopping mall that had been abandoned, one of these, you know, American strip malls or whatever. So they kind of reclaim a space like that. There'd be other examples. In America particularly, you know, the whole white flight into the suburbs and so forth, there'd be a lot of old abandoned churches that are kind of falling down but have nice atmospheric things. Some emerging groups kind of take over those churches and kind of sit in this atmospheric building that's that's falling down, as they like the ambiance of it. Others would meet in cafes, small rented spaces, you know, basically anywhere. And, you know, in like the dock itself, I mean, their regular Sunday meetings, right, was walking through the Titanic Quarter. You know, they don't even have a building. I suppose now they have the Nomadic once a month, but there's also examples of groups in America who would meet in an art gallery, and their kind of worship for the day would be walking together through and looking at images and discussing them and relating them to Christ and so on and so forth. So there's a huge variety of practices and meeting spaces.
I got the mic twice, so apologies in advance. I'll try and keep this very short. You mentioned that the Gospels are very important, I think, to emergent folk. One of the ways we're instructed in the Gospels to determine the validity or otherwise of any particular idea from a Christian context is testing the fruit, testing the product. Given that emergents aspire to live out Christianity, perhaps setting aside, if you would, the neo-monastics for a moment, there are still many evangelicals out serving in the third world, perhaps exposing themselves to Ebola or whatever. There are many of no faith doing that as well. Is there evidence? Is there work going on, organized work? Sometimes institutions are required to deliver product when it comes to serving others, organizing relief, providing healthcare, water, whatever. Is there evidence that that's happening within emergent communities?
Good question, right? So it brings to mind this sociologist called Josh Packard. He wrote a book about some of the emerging communities in the States. And one of the questions he asked the people in the communities he studied was, if your community disappeared tomorrow, would it make a difference in the city where you live? And some of them were kind of like, probably not, you know? So I think there's a sense that there's a striving towards, you know, the ideal of new monasticism. But like all of us, it's not always realized in the way that people might like. I do think, and again, we didn't do enough of a large-scale quantitative study, and nobody really has done, I don't think, of kind of seeing the types of career decisions and job choices and so forth that emerging Christians make and how those compare, say, to Christians in other denominations. Are they more likely to go into social work, service work, and so forth in their secular lives and live out their faith that way? We don't know for sure, but there is certainly plenty of evidence in people we interviewed of having made, for some people, you know, radical changes in their job and their career because while they might be taking a pay cut, they thought it was going to be to make a difference in the world and would be, you know, a better way of being a Christian. So there are examples of that, but the study really isn't on a large enough scale to know how prevalent that is, I suppose. But the point you make about needing an institution to organize, to do service, that's a very good point, you know, and in a sense have emerging Christians cut themselves off from doing that. I mean, that's a question you might ask. I think what a lot of them would say is that, well, we don't need to do it through a church institution. We'll do it through our career, through our other community networks. But at the same time, when you were saying that, it brought to mind some interviews I did for a totally different study, and I was interviewing people from a charismatic church down in Limerick, and one of the women, she was in her 60s, and she'd been at this charismatic church for 30 years or something like this, and it was always really small, but then when all the immigrants came, it got big, and she's like, it's great, because now we can do stuff, service in the community. Before, we were too small to make a difference, but now that we're bigger, you know, and we have this, she didn't put it in this terms, but now that we have this bigger institutional structure, we're able to do social work so much better. So, you know, you can see the problem and the tension, I suppose, that this anti-institutionalism brings with it. It has its strengths and it has its limitations.
Uh, I think we've been here a while, and I think that's
tired.
It's an awful lot of information and really, really good questions. I'm standing across there as the kind of the pastor, and I'm thinking, what from that am I listening to that resonates? Actually, not what I've read in books, but what I think about as I think about how to have a church in the centre of a city in 2014. And many of the questions I'm asking, I guess, are coming through in some of the things you're saying. For instance, as the pastor of this church, at a Tear Fund event just last week, it was very clear to all of us. There were 64 church leaders from across Northern Ireland in the room. And we were asked to talk about the forces around us in our society. And one of them was young people's suspicion of institutions. That's what emerging is. Now, what we have to do in that, if we want to survive as a church here, and I know there's many visitors with us tonight, so allow me to indulge that or put it back into a church if you go to one. What does that mean for us? And how do we respond to that? What will that mean for what God's doing? Because what we have to remember is the Presbyterian Church and Fitzroy Presbyterian Church is not the church. It's God's church worldwide. God's moving beyond us, though we thank him that he's moving within us. So what will that mean in the next number of years? I think one of the challenges, there's many challenges come out of tonight. Authentic living. Is it possible that with more authentic living from the institution and the creeds that we say we believe in, that there might not have been that suspicion? Community. Michael sent me 5 things that might keep this generation in church, and the first one was relationships. It's very, very important. I'm never ceased to be amazed at why some people go to certain churches that might not be as good as ours. And probably the reason is maybe not the worship, not the teaching, not the building, not the denominational name, but relationship. That's really, really important. What challenge does that lay down to us? Space to ask questions. Is that something that Presbyterianism has been able to do? Or have we given too glib and sanitized answers to people's questions and fears? Shaking the complacency. Is there anything worse than being a nice, respectable, middle-class Presbyterian? I think the devil settles for that. I think the devil's incredibly happy with that, because it's not necessarily the revolutionary upside-down world that the Gospels talk about. And interestingly, Tear Fund in the next number of months are going to launch something, come here in a couple of weeks' time if you want the stepping stone to that, which is going to challenge us not to give money in an envelope or not to sign a card, but to actually live a life outside of a capitalist system that's unjust. That's now coming into mainstream. We're starting to ask questions about, is this the way to live, or are we conformed to the pattern of this world? And my last question out of it is this, and we need to maybe go home with this. If Fitzroy closed down tomorrow, if the Presbyterian Church in Ireland closed down tomorrow, who would notice? They're just questions I think we need to ask from some of the stuff you're saying. Anything you want to say and comment to the pastor's critique, or?
I think I'll leave it at that.
Can we thank Gladys very much?
Thanks.
Who would that book up? This is the book, The Deconstructed Church, Understanding Emerging Christianity. It really is worth getting your head around these things, because not because you will either agree or disagree with emergent or emerging church, but maybe some of the questions I'm asking as a pastor of an institutional church might come out from the reading of it. And we certainly here in our church will need to be asking those questions over the next 5, 10, 15 years. Sadly, she doesn't have copious amounts of it tonight.
Yes, I overestimated the number of copies I had left from the event that Pete had in May. So I've actually only one copy for sale for £15. So
there's one copy at knockdown price, but you would need to knock Gladys down in order to get it, is what we're trying to say.
But I will say that it's only about £20 on Amazon. So for an academic book, that's pretty reasonable.
It's very good. There is tea and coffee. There is Gladys. There are the rest of us. Let's be involved in conversation, community and relationships. Let's outdo emerging in the course of the next 20 minutes or so. Let's pray together before we do that. Lord, we thank you for the church. We thank you for what we believe, and yet we thank you for the times that were critiqued, for the times during history of Reformation, times when we've had to readjust to new movements within our society. And we pray that we would not be complacent. We pray, Lord, that we would be asking these questions, open to ask questions, and to find a way that we can take your church worldwide forward to be a missional church and to be a church that glorifies you in the world and brings your good news to the world and shines your light into darkness and makes us authentic followers of Jesus. So I pray, Lord, as we take many of the questions and answers that have come out of tonight home, that we would really rigorously ask these questions, seeking your Spirit's guidance to the answers. In Jesus' name, amen. Tea and coffee and conversation, let's make it happen.